Seekers, Mike Malloy here. Tricked you into tuning in again tonight, huh? Damn, I'm getting good at this. Welcome to Wednesday night's program. This is a church night, but I'm going to try to avoid it as much as I can, except for one rabbi story that I have that is kind of freaky. Did you see some of this video making the rounds of Glenn Beck over in Israel? Trying to be, I don't know, Moses. This guy is so far down the rabbit hole now, he's going to run into himself one of these days. It's just astonishing. Well, Where to start? Dear God, where to start? Well, first of all, I'll start by saying this first hour is sponsored once again by Anonymous. And the message from Anonymous is, always remember, Michael, we have your back. I think this is something Marge would have agreed with. Huh. Well, these are just getting more and more mysterious. Okay. Thanks, Anonymous. Where to start? I think this would be a good place to start. I want to share something with you here real quick. Fairly quick read. Listen to this. Generally, readers of the press, newspapers, and mass media can be classified into three groups. First, those who believe everything they're told. Second, those who no longer believe anything. And third, those who critically examine what they're told and form their judgments accordingly. All right, let me start over. Generally, readers of the press can be classified into three groups. First, those who believe everything they're told. Second, those who no longer believe anything. And third, those who critically examine what they're told and form their judgments accordingly. The first group is by far the strongest, being composed of the broad masses of the people. Intellectually, it forms the simplest portion of the nation. It cannot be classified according to occupation, but only into grades of intelligence. Under this category come all those who have not been born to think for themselves, or who have not learned to do so, and who, partly through incompetence and partly through ignorance, believe everything that is set before them by newspapers and the mass media. To these, we must add that type of lazy individual who, although capable of thinking for himself, out of sheer laziness, gratefully absorbs everything that others had thought over, modestly believing this to have been thoroughly done. The influence which the press has on all these people is therefore enormous. For after all, they constitute the broad masses of a nation. But somehow, they are not in a position or are not willing personally to sift what is being served up to them, so that their whole attitude toward daily problems is almost solely the result of extraneous influence. All this can be advantageous when public enlightenment is of a serious and truthful character, but great harm is done when scoundrels and liars take a hand at this work. Now, the second group, those who no longer believe anything, is numerically smaller, being partly composed of those who were formerly in the first group and after a series of bitter disappointments, are now prepared to believe nothing of what they're told. They hate all newspapers and mass media. Either they do not read them at all, or they become exceptionally annoyed at their contents, which they hold to be nothing but a series of lies and misstatements. These people are difficult to handle, for they will always be skeptical of the truth. Consequently, they are useless for any form of positive work. And the third group is easily the smallest, those who critically examine what they're told and form their judgments accordingly. This group being composed of real intellectuals whom natural aptitude and education have taught to think for themselves, and who in all things try to form their own judgments while at the same time carefully sifting what they read. They will not read any newspaper without using their own intelligence to collaborate with that of the writer. And naturally, this does not set writers an easy task. Journalists appreciate this type of reader only with a certain amount of reservation. Conclusion. Hence, the trash that newspapers and the mass media are capable of serving up is of little danger, much less of importance to the members of the third group of readers, the ones who critically examine what they're told. In the majority of cases, these readers have learned to regard every journalist as fundamentally a rogue who sometimes speaks the truth. Most unfortunately, the value of these readers lies in their intelligence and not in their numerical strength. An unhappy state of affairs in a period where wisdom counts for nothing and majorities for everything. Nowadays, when the voting papers of the masses are the deciding factor, the decision lies in the hands of the numerically strongest group. That is to say, the first group, the crowd of simpletons and the credulous. Wow. Who wrote that? The decisions lie in the hands of the numerically strongest group. That is to say, the first group, the crowd of simpletons and the credulous. Well, it was written while the author was in jail, in prison, actually. And he was there because he led something called the beer hall pooch. Pushed. It's from Mein Kampf, written by A. Hitler. Wow. How does that compare with what goes on? The other reason I bring that up, it is absolutely applicable now. Absolutely. There's no question. Oh, well. Too many comparisons to the Führer, right? From Steve? Is this from Steve? As always, Mike, you hit the nail on the head. At the bloviating, all the bloviating going on about how another dictator fell just lends lie to the it was never about regime change. What he's referring to is in the Wall Street Journal, an article, I think it was today, former Defense Secretary William Gates says it was not about regime change. The attack on Libya was not about regime change. Not at all. I'm only 40 years old, Steve writes. I've never seen war in my face like it was in Vietnam. It's so sterile now with unmanned drones and this and that and whatever. And you know what? Even with all that sterilization, I'm just tired of it. And I can't understand how more people aren't just tired of death and destruction and hate of, quote, those people, end quote. On another note, something keeps coming back to me. Bush talked constantly about a wave of freedom sweeping the Middle East after 9/11. Perpetrator Saddam Hussein fell. Yes, I'm being tongue-in-cheek here. I'm looking at what's happening now as our liberal president knocks down the dominoes one by one and can't help but think that that was all part of a bigger plan. Whoever would have thought that a black man whose single mother raised him, who had an absent father, and who spent time on welfare would grow up to break the race barrier, win election to the White House, and would be nothing but the continuation of the most murderous regime in U.S. history. Who would have thought any of that? Maybe I'm just a conspiracy theorist, but the whole thing has a methodical, non-random feel to it. Steve.
Soothing bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. I had to do that little excerpt from Mein Kampf to try to get, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but try to get my mind off a story that I saw on ABC World News tonight, and then went to their website and got more of the story. It was one of David Muir's, and it's about hunger in the United States, about how it is affecting children. One out of every four children these days is what's the term that they use? Food insecure, meaning their parents don't know where the next meal is going to come from. 17 million children are now food insecure. And overall, one in six Americans don't have enough to eat. Now, I know immediately we're going to think, well, then why is everybody so overweight? Well, in the first place, obesity is not an indication of enough food to eat. It's an indication of disease. The quality of food, the type of food. I mean, for $2, you can walk into a convenience store and walk out with enough poisonous, fat-filled carbohydrates to add 5 pounds to your backside. That's not what we're talking about. They used a couple of examples. Dawn and Michael McKimmons lived near Fort Smith, Arkansas. And they moved into a trailer to save money. Dawn works at a hotel while Michael delivers pizzas. They've taken whatever jobs they could find, but it's still not enough to feed their little family. They make do with help from their local food bank and try to shield their three little girls from the daily struggle. Dawn says, quote, I hear my kids ask me, Mommy, what's for dinner? And I sit there at times. I sit there and I kind of just pace back and forth, think to myself, oh my gosh, what is for dinner? Outside Atlanta, the Sutton family slipped from the middle class when Bob Sutton's concrete company went bankrupt. Michelle Sutton, his wife, said she used to be a typical soccer mom, but not anymore. She told ABC News that her 11-year-old son hugged her and said, wow, you feel skinny, Mom. And the founder of Witnesses to Hunger, one Dr. Mariana Chilton, says the recession has hit the middle class hard. She says people who have been middle class are now struggling to put food on the table and feeling an enormous amount of stress. They're starting to experience the pain of poverty, of what it's like to be poor. In Philadelphia, 10-year-old kid, Jasair Sutton, knows that it's the end of the month when the food stamps have long rung out. His mother is trying to finish her degree so she can find work. When asked what is toughest for him, the 10-year-old says, quote, "When I eat and my mom doesn't, she sacrifices," end quote. And if you could have seen the kid actually say those words, like I did on the video tonight, it really will pierce you. Before this recession brought about by the greed son of a bitches, the capitalists on Wall Street, all these pigs, these murderous bastards who brought this about, before the recession, 26 million Americans were on food stamps. Today, that number is approaching 50 million. And the right-wingers want to cut back the food stamps. They want to end it. The teabaggers, they want to end women, infants, and children feeding programs and food stamps. End it. Because food stamps prevent people from grabbing a hold of their bootstraps and finding a job, don't you know? The little boy, the 10-year-old, that says, when I eat and my mom doesn't, that's what's the toughest for him to bear. He said when he grows up, he wants to be a senator. And he's written to Senator Robert Casey, Democrat of PA, to ask for help. Without a car, Sutton and his mom are forced to walk to Rite Aid. You know what that is? A drugstore to buy food. See what I mean? Rite Aid is the closest store. There's no supermarket nearby. St. Christopher's Hospital in Philadelphia is ground zero for hunger, according to ABC. The emergency room there might see 250 children a day, and up to half of them are hungry. The ER director at this hospital said they don't have the growth that they should. What disturbs me is that a child's brain grow. That's when your brain grows in your childhood, and nutrition is what's important to your brain's growth. In the United States, what did we talk about the other night? We spent close to $1 billion bombing and murdering people in Libya. And we have kids who... Oh, well.
Radio matters here.
Before the hour, this hour is being sponsored by Anonymous. Anonymous writes, "Always remember, Michael, we have your back." I think this is something Marge would have agreed with. Anonymous. Farm workers in California and their allies began a 200-mile march yesterday that will last nearly 2 weeks and is aimed at convincing Governor Jerry Brown, Democrat of California, to sign legislation that would improve working conditions and pay for thousands of California farm workers. The march began in Madera, California, will end in Sacramento. If passed, the legislation that they're marching about would, first, guarantee the right for farm workers to be paid overtime after 8 hours a day and 40 hours a week, you know, like other workers. Second, make it easier for farm workers to join unions. Would you think that would be difficult to do? I guess. Third, ensure that the workers get bathroom breaks and water. Jesus Christ, that takes an act of the California legislature. And fourth, strengthen heat regulations that are not currently being enforced, which have led to a number of deaths due to heat-related illness. Mm-hmm. Similar legislation was vetoed by California Democratic Governor Jerry Brown earlier in the year. Vetoed. Bathroom breaks and water? Overtime if they work over 40 hours a week? Is there any liberal, any progressive in elective office left anywhere in the country? Anywhere. Will someone shoot me an email, tell me one? There has to be. Right? In vetoing the legislation earlier this year, Brown said that he wasn't yet convinced of the need for passing this legislation called the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act. United Farm Workers, gosh, are they still in existence? Responded strongly to that rationale. They said, quote, in Governor Brown's veto of the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act, he says he is not yet convinced. For farm workers, not yet convinced means farm workers don't get water. Not yet convinced means that farm workers continue to die of heat illness. Not yet convinced means farm workers do not have basic justice implemented by the Agricultural Labor Relations Act. Not yet convinced means hundreds of farm workers who last year voted for union representation have waited more than a year for the Agricultural Labor Relations Board to take the simple act of certifying the elections. And Governor Jerry Brown, Democrat of California, is not yet convinced of the need for passing the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act. Didn't Jerry Brown at one time march with Cesar Chavez? Didn't Jerry Brown at one time advocate and participate in boycotts of, remember, boycott lettuce? Jesus Christ, how many centuries ago was that? Boycott grapes, remember? You have to go way back to the 70s, folks. Do you remember? Do you even know who Cesar Chavez was? Huelga! Does that word mean anything to you? No? Nothing? Okay. Whatever. Jerry Brown. I seem to remember Jerry Brown being very active with the United Farm Workers Union. God, that was long ago, wasn't it? I don't think it ever happened. Nah, just a trick of memory. Not Jerry Brown, not a governor, not a Democratic governor who says he's not yet convinced of the need for passing the Fair Treatment for Farm Workers Act. Nah, something happened. Something terrible happened. Jerry Brown, between being the youngest governor ever to take office in California and being the oldest governor ever to take office in California, something happened. Something must have happened. That Jerry Brown doesn't see any need, he's not convinced of the need for legislation when people can't go take a pee? Or they'll lose their job? You're kidding me. Well, for those of you who just can't seem to break your drug addiction, keep voting Democratic. Just keep, it doesn't matter anyway. But just keep doing that. Hey, how about this? You know, all this braying and noise making by the Senate's three top hawks about how the U.S. wasn't doing enough to get rid of Libyan dictator, leader, crazy person, Muammar Gaddafi from power? Huh? According to Ali Gharib, writing at Think Progress, you might be surprised to learn that exactly 2 years ago, Senators John McCain, Joe Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham were in Tripoli, Libya, meeting with Gaddafi and giving him assurances that relations between the U.S. and Libya were on the mend. Where does this come from? Remember I told you last night WikiLeaks had leaked some cables about Libya? Well, this is one of them. According to a leaked August 2009 diplomatic cable released by WikiLeaks recounting the senator's junket, the neoconservative Connecticut senator, that would be Lieberman, captured the dynamic of aligning with a brutal dictator. Lieberman called Libya an important ally in the war on terrorism, noting that common enemies sometimes make better friends. You know, if they both have the same enemy. Jesus Christ. And who's been screaming the loudest, right? The three tenors, McCain, Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham. My God. Senator McCain at this meeting assured Gaddafi's son, Mutasim, that the United States wanted to provide Libya with the equipment it needs for its security program. McCain stated that he understood Libya's request regarding the rehabilitation of its eight C-130s and pledged to see, McCain pledged to see what he could do to move things forward in Congress. He encouraged Gaddafi's son to keep in mind the long-term perspective of bilateral security engagement and to remember that small obstacles will emerge from time to time, but they will be overcome. At another point, according to the WikiLeaks cable, McCain and Lindsey Graham reiterated pledges to push to fulfill the Gaddafi regime's request at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill. Quote, Senators McCain and Graham conveyed the U.S. interest in continuing the progress of the bilateral relationship and pledged to try to resolve the C-130 issue with the Congress and Defense Secretary Gates. Oh. 18 months later, Gaddafi reacted to mass protests by mobilizing his military, bringing down international condemnation. And in just a few short weeks, a UN Security Council resolution authorizing the use of force. To do what? The U.S. and its allies in NATO and elsewhere rained down bombs to hold Gaddafi's forces at bay as rebels organized an opposition council. As the rebels went on the offensive, Western and Allied bombers lent them air support with surveillance and tactical bombings. When suddenly, as if Gaddafi's repression had emerged from out of the blue, yeah, McCain and Lieberman and Graham. You see, 2 years ago, Gaddafi was not a repressive thug dictator. No, 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 no. He was a potential customer. But when McCain and his little clique of warmongers returned to their perches as the staunchest advocates of U.S. military action in Libya, taking to the airwaves to lament the U.S.'s mere three-week delay to build internal consensus and calling for arming the Libya rebels, our famous news media never said a word, did it? WikiLeaks. You can find it all online, WikiLeaks.org.
He's the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malone.
10 before the hour, you can contact Governor Jerry Brown if you want to about the march for farm workers. You can go to jerrybrown.org, and if you want to, you'll find ways there how to contact him. Or you can go to gov.ca.gov. But jerrybrown.org is a good place to start. And if you want to, read his bio. And then try to figure out why he's not convinced that farm workers need legislation in order to have a drink of water. Jesus, God. This hour has been sponsored by Anonymous, who writes, always remember, Michael, quote, we have your back, end quote. I think this is something Marge would have agreed with. You're a longtime listener of this program. You know who Marge was. Thanks, Anonymous. Gulf Coast residents were featured on day five, that's today, of the tar sands action at the White House. A Gulf delegation came to the nation's capital to share their experiences with the BP oil spill and to warn the president about the true cost of the country's addiction to oil. What was it Mr. President said? Let's be the generation that finally frees America from the tyranny of oil. The tyranny. And he's about to authorize a 1,700-mile Trans-America, Trans-United States pipeline from the tar sand fields of Alberta to Texas, crossing, I think, three or four of this country's aquifers, farmland. And when the accident comes, it's going to be horrific. Many in the delegation that went to D.C. today from the Gulf Coast expected to be arrested and were. Thus far, 220 Americans have been jailed, speaking out against the Keystone XL pipeline. And Bill McKibben, who is the principal organizer for these demonstrations against the tar sands extraction and Keystone XL pipeline, was interviewed last night by Keith Olbermann on Countdown. And he said a few things that I have here. He said it's going to be gut check time for the president. When he ran for president, the night he was nominated, in fact, he said, you know what? When I'm president, the rise of the oceans will begin to slow. And the planet will begin to heal, end quote. That's powerful talk. He hasn't yet done heroic things on the environment. He's done some good things around the edges, but nothing transformative. And he's backed down on some important fights. This time he can't blame it on Congress. He doesn't have to, ask Jim Inhofe for permission. He doesn't need any help from the Congress. He can turn down this permit himself. And if he does, and here, I think, is the political calculation. If he does, it will send a surge of excitement through that base. We were sitting, McKibben goes on, lying on the metal shelves in what's called the central cell block in the Washington jail the other day. And people were saying, you know, the last time I was this uncomfortable, I was lying in a church basement getting ready to go knock on doors for Barack Obama. I sure hope I get reminded of why I was doing that. If you go to Fire Dog Lake, you'll see a piece there by John Chandley. It's very good. John was one of the people that was arrested, and he can give you at firedoglake.com or .org. I think it's .com. You'll find it. He can give you a report of what it was like when the authorities broke the agreement that they had Make your political statement. Exercise your First Amendment rights. We'll exercise our right to arrest you. You post your $100 bond or $100 fine, and you leave. But they didn't do that. As an example to other people who might have the absolute temerity as to show up and try to exercise their First Amendment right any place, but especially in front of the Obama White House, you will go to jail and you will stay in jail until they decide to release you. Huh? But some of my colleagues in media will continue to tell you that Barack Obama is a liberal or progressive. Don't pay any attention to what the half-witted morons out there, the ones that were written about in Mein Kampf, what they say about Obama. Oh, he's a socialist. Oh, he's a Muslim. Oh, he's a foreigner. Oh, he's a blah, blah, blah. It shows the incredible depth of ignorance and stupidity inside these baggers' heads. I don't know how I live in the same country with these people. I really don't. I really don't. He's a socialist. God. No, what pisses you baggers off is that he is a black man. That's what really gets in your craw, you phony bastards. You know it is. You know it is. That transcends everything. His being a Democrat, it doesn't make any difference, all of it. Well, we got to get rid of that guy. He looks like somebody ought to be out stealing hubcaps, not the President of the United States. Oh, my God, you bunch of racist pigs. We'll be right back. And when we come back, we're going to have a little church or synagogue. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. The hour. This is the Malloy program. All right, I've got one here for you. A letter sent yesterday to the ACLU and to United/Continental Airlines and or the willing private lawyer, anybody to read this and to listen to make some decisions here. Here it is. To whom it may concern, my name is Vance Gilbert. I live in Arlington, Massachusetts. I'm a homeowner, having been here 10 plus years. I have a partner, and we have 2 52-pound standard poodles. I'm a 6-foot-tall, bespeckled, slightly graying, 52-year-old, 230-pound African-American male with a close haircut. On August 14th, a couple of weeks ago, I boarded United Airlines flight 3483 from Boston to Dulles on time and was seated in an aisle seat, seat number 9C. I was dressed in shorts, baseball hat, T-shirt, hiking boots, and unbuttoned Jimmy Buffett Hawaiian shirt covered with airplanes. As the door was being closed, we were told it was a full flight, meaning 70 to 80 people. I had my backpack under the seat in front of me and my fanny pack and wallet behind my heels. After the doors were closed, the flight attendant came down the aisle checking security, buckling, bag clearance, all that stuff, and asked if she could put my fanny pack above me in the overhead bin. I replied to her that I'd be just fine just sitting it next to my backpack under the seat in front of me, as it contained my wallet, etc., and that I'd rather have it near. She seemed fine with that resolution. All that was done without consternation or belligerence, and I thought nothing of it. Now, I am a musician by trade and an amateur aviation historian, studying mostly European transport aircraft between World War I and World War II, and some after. I was on my way to two different music festivals. When I travel, I delve into reading about this era of aviation. I had taken out and was reading a book of Polish aircraft, circa 1946, and I was also looking at views of an Italian aircraft from 1921. I think you see where this is going. The plane went all the way out to the takeoff point, in the queue for takeoff. All the while, I noticed a lot of people, phone pinging back and forth between the flight attendants. The young woman flight attendant was also crouched next to me and conversing seriously to a deadheading pilot about four seats up on the other side. The plane then proceeded to turn around and head all the way back to the gate. Once at the gate, the jet bridge was positioned. The captain announced, "We have a minor issue and we will continue our departure once it's resolved." He, the pilot, left the aircraft. After about 5 or 10 minutes, two Massachusetts state policemen, one or two TSA agents, and the bursar for the flight came down the aisle and motioned me to get off the plane. I don't remember if they called me by name. We stepped out into the breezeway where one of the state policemen asked how I was doing that day. I replied, "Sir, I think you're going to tell me I could be doing much better." Policeman, "Did you have a problem with your bag earlier?" Me, "No, sir, not at all. The flight attendant wanted it secured elsewhere other than behind my feet, and I opted to put it under the seat in front of me. It's my wallet, even though there's only $30 in it, and all that was done without belligerence or words for that matter. It was all good." A few beats. Policeman, "Sir, were you looking at a book of airplanes?" Me, "Yes, sir, I was. I'm a musician for money, but for fun I study old aircraft and build models of them, and the book I was reading was a Polish aircraft from 1946. Policeman, "Would you please go get that book so I can see it?" I go back onto the plane. All eyes are on me like I was a common criminal. Total humiliation, part two. After a couple of minutes, he says, "Why, this is all Snoopy Red Baron stuff." Me, "Yes, sir. Actually, the triplane you see is Italian from 1921, a little after World War I. Policeman, "All right, no problem here then. You can go on back on the plane. Sorry to inconvenience you, and have a nice flight." We were now, at least after re-queuing, over an hour late. No one looked me in the eye, flight attendants, passengers. I missed my next connection and had to cancel that portion of the flight and rent a car, $270, plus fuel, $30, to my work. I lost half wages, $100, and I was afraid to read for the next two flights. I silently wept the whole flight to D.C. I've never been so frightened or humiliated. I'm shaking even as I write this. How much money was lost between the airline, the other travelers, I couldn't begin to calculate. How damaged am I from this experience? Well, I'm not feeling particularly American. I'm angry, dumbfounded, frightened. Would this have happened to the 30-ish Caucasian woman sitting across the aisle from me, who left her seat, water bottle, and book never to be seen for the rest of the completely full flight? Is it now against the law to be dark and read a book about historic aircraft? What's my takeaway from this experience as a taxpayer, United Airlines patron, black man, teacher, mentor, American? I was brokenhearted and speechless as I overheard my friend's wife try to explain to her kids what happened to me and what her husband and I were talking about over dinner. The kids never did understand why. What do I tell your children? Enough? What do I do now? Please advise. Please contact me at the email above. Thanks in advance. Vance Gilbert, Arlington, Mass. Also known as Flying While Black and Reading Antique Aviation Books. Wow, huh? That letter was dated yesterday. Thanks to Ken in Hemet, California, who sent that to me. Unbelievable. He was reading a book on antique aircraft. Well, yeah, obviously a terrorist. Had to have been. Oh, and this is from, who's this from? Butler? Speaking of poverty and how desperate people are, this is data from today. Another alleged coupon thief is arrested. Here's a youngish-looking white woman. This one is accused of waiting on the Dollar Tree newspaper delivery on Sunday morning around 3 or 4 a.m., then grabbing some newspapers, driving a mile away, parking, removing the inserts, and then returning the papers to the store. Christina Soward was booked at McMinn County Justice Center. This happened near Chattanooga. Nice, huh? She stole the discount coupon inserts. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to do a little bit of church. It is Wednesday, prayer meeting night. We're going to be ecumenical tonight and do some evangelical Protestant crap and some insane rabbi crap. So stick around.
Free zone. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. You know, last hour I think I referred to former Secretary of Defense Gates as William Gates instead of Robert. And nobody sent me an email? What? What does that mean? Jeremy in Burlington, Vermont points out something that I heard tonight too, and I thought, what? Tonight, the CBS News said that there is now a $2 million bounty for the capture of Gaddafi, dead or alive, I might add. Go figure. You know what I mean, Mike? Jeremy in Burlington. Yeah, who's putting up $2 million? Dead or alive? Really? Well, there's... Jesus Christ. A New York rabbi claims gay marriage and the earthquake that shook the East Coast are directly connected. Man, if I were a gay man, I would probably become a terrorist. Because I wouldn't, I used to say that about, if I were a black man, I probably would either be in prison or dead or in a mental institution by now. And I was saying that back when I was in my 40s because I just couldn't have taken it. I just couldn't have. And I feel the same way now about folks who happen to be gay. I mean, is there anything that these religious, insane people don't try to pin on gay folk? Now, this is that famous rabbi, Levin. What's his name? What's his first name? He's a supporter of Randall Terry's bid to run as a Democrat for president. You didn't know that? Yeah. Anyway, Yehuda Levin. In a video uploaded to YouTube, Levin says gay rights legislation, like the gay marriage law passed in New York, are responsible for earthquakes, like the one that struck not in New York, but in Washington and Virginia Tuesday. Levin says, the Talmud states you have shaken your male member in a place where it doesn't belong. I, too, will shake the earth. Really? Is that in the Talmud? You have shaken your male member in a place where it doesn't belong. I, too, will shake the earth. He also notes that he doesn't dislike gay people. He says, we don't hate homosexuals. I feel bad for homosexuals. It's a revolt against God. And literally, there's hell to pay. Oh, my God. That's easy for me to laugh at because I'm white and not gay. But the humor that I see in this insane son of a bitch saying this stuff is not, I would doubt, shared by people who happen to be gay. Because it's this kind of stuff that leads to brutality, beatings, murder. On Top Magazine reports that Joseph Farah, that psychopathic son of a bitch who's the editor of WorldNetDaily.com, feels the same way. You'd think the earthquake should have knocked the hell out of New York City instead of Virginia, where gay marriage isn't legal. It is legal in New York, right? You'd think that God would have a better concept of geography. I mean, after all, for Christ's sake, Rabbi, didn't he make this place? He doesn't know from Virginia. Levin is a vocal religious nutbag and opposes gay rights and also a woman's right to privacy where it concerns whether or not she wants to have an abortion. He's also a member of the advisory committee on the, of the organization Jews Against Anti-Christian Defamation. What? He tends, according to what I have here, where did I get this? Wikipedia? He tends to be in alliance with Christian evangelicals on efforts opposed to homosexual rights and other issues. In 1996, he supported Pat Buchanan for president. Pat Buchanan, the most anti-Semitic media political figure in America. Pat Buchanan and this crazy bastard, Rabbi Yehuda Levin, aligns himself and supports Pat Buchanan? Levin was involved in stopping a gay pride event from taking place in Jerusalem. He's the one who supported the use of violence by protesters in opposing the planned event, saying, quote, I promise there's going to be bloodshed in Jerusalem because gay folk want to march for human rights. Oh, my. And in October last year, Levin worked with Carl Paladino. Remember that psychopath? When Paladino was running for what, governor? And Paladino prepared an anti-gay statement. Paladino and Levin. And then Paladino read it in an Orthodox Jewish community meeting. And, of course, it made national news. Levin also blamed the 2010 Haiti earthquake on the presence of homosexuals in the military, our military. And he claimed that the violent, vicious murder of Leiby Kletsky, that little kid that was abducted in the Orthodox Jewish community and dismembered, that was caused by gay marriage being made legal in the state of New York. Is this son of a bitch out of his mind or what?
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Email here from a Jewish non-believer who says, Levin, Rabbi Yehuda Levin is really Meshuggah. We can claim Jesus, Marx, Freud, and Einstein, the four Jews who changed the world. We're entitled to one really big mistake. Well, I just wanted to bring up Rabbi Levin just to sort of equal opportunity religion bashing. It's not just fundamentalist Christians. It's not just jihadist Muslims. You know, the Jews have their little nest of crazy people, too. And don't even get me started on the Hindus. Joseph Farah, the editor of WorldNetDaily.com, agrees with this rabbi that the earthquake was God's judgment on America. And this psychopath Farah suggested gay rights were to blame. Where did this swine come from? Under what rocks do these people emerge from under? I mean, seriously, this is what this dork said. Washington, D.C. deserves more than the wallop it got today. Nice talk, you crazy bastard. That's the capital of your country, punk. It needs a much bigger shaking up than it got. And I have no doubt that that's coming, unless there's a real change of heart in the leadership of this country. After all, if America doesn't face judgment soon, God will have to apologize for Sodom and Gomorrah, and God doesn't offer apologies. He's trying to tell us something. His message is very clear. Don't say you weren't warned. Joseph Farah, the editor of World Net Daily, who belongs in a World Net Daily, or some kind of a net. Scoop this crazy bastard up, please! Joseph Farah and Rabbi, oh yeah, and Levin is, yeah, there's somebody who wants to run against Obama from the Democratic far right, Randall Terry. Is he still around? I thought he choked to death on a, I don't know, on a condom or something. Randall Terry's still around? Oh, my God. You remember him. Operation Rescue. Bah! Now, this is really cool. George in Oregon sent this to me. He said, I got this today from Steve Pizzo. It's right in with the Hitler piece you read. This group that we're about to tell you about is in Hitler's first group, those who believe everything that's presented to them, unless it happens to be logical. Now, what this comes from, Mark Knoll, N-O-L-L, he's an evangelical history professor at Evangelical Wheaton College. That's just outside Chicago. Remember, we were in a forum out there, Kathy, remember? He begins his book. He's written a book called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. Now, the guy is an evangelical history professor at Evangelical Wheaton College. And he begins the book this way. The scandal of the evangelical mind is that there is not much of an evangelical mind. He goes on to say, American evangelicals are not exemplary for their thinking. And they have not been so for several generations. He points out that evangelicals support dozens of theological seminaries, scores of colleges, hundreds of radio stations, but not a single research university. He goes on, in the United States, it is simply impossible to be with integrity both evangelical and intellectual. Modern American evangelicals, he writes, have failed notably in sustaining serious intellectual life. Is this him writing? I think it is. I have found nothing in my research that disagrees with this assessment. Indeed, almost all of the findings in the last chapter of the book about the authoritarian followers' penchants for illogical thinking, compartmentalized minds, double standards, hypocrisy, and dogmatism apply to religious fundamentalists as well. For example, David Winter at the University of Michigan recently found that fundamentalist students, when evaluating the war in Iraq, rejected a series of statements that were based on the Sermon on the Mount, which is arguably the core of the teachings of Jesus. Fundamentalists may believe they follow Jesus more than anyone else does, but it turns out to depend a lot on where Jesus said we should go. And we can augment such findings by considering the thinking behind three of the fundamentalists' favorite issues: school prayer, opposition to evolution, and the infallibility of the Bible. In the United States, it is simply impossible to be with integrity both evangelical and intellectual. Well, of course, all religion has at its base, really, truly, one absolute requirement, because without this requirement, religion fails utterly and totally. And that one requirement, base requirement, is you must suspend your logical mind. You must turn it off. Totally. And if you cannot do that, then you may not share in this religious nonsense about things in the air and haints and risings from the dead and all, you know, all of this stuff. Unless you are able to shut off your intellect. What do they say in the church? Well, you got to have faith, brother. Amen. You got to have faith. Can you explain any of this to me? No, you have to accept it on faith. But if I can't do that, then you'll burn in hell. Oh, so those are my choices. Accept all this crazy superstitious nonsense, which is all based on this horrific fear of dying, or I'll burn in hell anyway. Right. Jesus, God. Oh, well. Here's somebody wants to know how long it'll be before we have a card game or a deck of cards out about Gaddafi and the rest of his people, sort of like the deck we made for Iraq. That's a good question. It's coming. I'm sure it's coming. I'm sure it's coming. The United States, United Kingdom, France, and Italy targeted the Libyan government for overthrow or regime change, not because these governments were worried about protecting civilians or to bring about a more democratic form of government in Libya. If that were the real motivation of the NATO powers, they could start the bombing of Saudi Arabia right away. There are no elections in Saudi Arabia. The monarchy does not even allow women to drive cars. By law, women must be fully covered in public or they will go to prison. Protests are rare in Saudi Arabia because any dissent is met with imprisonment, torture, and execution. The Saudi monarchy is protected by U.S. imperialism because It is part of an undeclared but real U.S. sphere of influence, and it is the largest producer of oil in the world. The U.S. attitude toward the Saudi monarchy was put succinctly by Ronald Reagan in 1981 when he said that the U.S. government will not permit revolution in Saudi Arabia, such as the 1979 Iranian Revolution, that removed the U.S. client regime of the Shah. Reagan's message was clear. The Pentagon and CIA's military forces would be used decisively to destroy any democratic movement against the rule of the Saudi royal family. Reagan's explicit statement in 1981 has, in fact, been the policy of every successive U.S. administration, including the current one. This is from Brian Becker, who is the national coordinator of the Answer Coalition. You can read more by going to answercoalition.org. Answercoalition.org. Brian Becker is a good writer. You don't hear too much about Brian Becker, do you? The speech that he has, The Truth About the Situation in Libya, is lengthy, and I thought what I would do is just occasionally, since the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime is front and center in the news, they're still all breathless about it, aren't they? Huh? They just can't stop talking about it on the news programs.
We got him. Well, no, we didn't. We can't find him. Well, I'll tell you what, let's put a bounty on his head.
Who's putting up the $2 million? Do you wonder about that? Do you also wonder that 2 years ago, the three tenors from the U.S. Senate were over there offering this guy all kinds of deals with the Pentagon?
No abuse.
10 before the hour. Next hour, I'm going to talk about New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and what happened to him yesterday and why it happened. Okay? Stick around for that. Some of the families of the victims of the 9/11 attack on this country, which was engineered one way or the other by the Bush crime family, either through deliberate action or negligence. Relatives of some of those victims were headed to Washington earlier today to meet with Attorney General Eric Holder about allegations surrounding Rupert Murdoch's phone hacking scandal in the UK. According to Huffington Post, a former, and they are quoting London newspapers based on unnamed sources, not that that matters in the UK. A former New York police officer who became a private investigator said he rejected requests by journalists from Rupert Murdoch's News of the World to retrieve private phone records of September 11 victims. Now, I want you to hear this. The U.S.-based parent company for Murdoch's News Corporation has called this report, quote, anonymous speculation, end quote, with, quote, no substantiation, end quote. Now, that's what's referred to as a non-denial denial. Rather than coming out and saying, that's a bunch of crap, that never happened, they call it anonymous speculation, with no substantiation. You can't prove that. Norman Siegel, an attorney representing some of the 9/11 victims' relatives, said the family members want to cooperate with the FBI and the Department of Justice, quote, to determine if such hacking was attempted and or occurred, end quote. Siegel added, we're going to the meeting with the Attorney General to listen to what he can tell us about the investigation and to ascertain the scope, the goals, and the timetable of the inquiry, end quote. Retired New York Deputy Fire Chief Jim Riches was among family members from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut taking that trip today to attend the meeting with Holder. Riches said federal investigators, quote, have permission to investigate my cell lines, my families, whatever they need, end quote, to find out to what degree this filthy pigsty, this terrorist broadcast organization called Fox News or the Murdoch terror empire, to what extent they did hack into the private phone messages of victims' families from 9/11. Riches said, oh, by the way, he lost his son, firefighter Jimmy Riches, who was 29 in the attacks and also was involved in search and recovery efforts at the World Trade Center site. The dad was doing what he called, quote, picking up body parts, end quote. Riches said, we just want some information, whether these allegations are actually true or not true. We feel we deserve to know. He said, if the allegations are true, the families affected should be notified and those responsible should be held accountable. He added, something like this, a terrible loss, losing a son like that, I don't think anybody has a right to pry into our personal lives. He said, we wouldn't want something so horrible for someone else to be listening. Nobody should invade that kind of privacy. He added, we live 9/11 every day. My son is never going to walk through the door again. There will never be any closure. So, what do you think? I mean, I just based on the old idea that if somebody does something in one part of town that's criminal and vile and they get away with it, they'll do the same thing in another part of town that's criminal and vile until they get caught. So based on that, I am pretty much convinced, not in a legal sense, not beyond a reasonable doubt, I'm just convinced, a gut feeling, you know, that the Murdoch broadcast terror empire in this country and in Australia did exactly the same thing as the Murdoch broadcast terror organization did in the UK. Why would they do something that worked so effectively for them there and not here? There is no logical reason as to why they wouldn't. It's just a matter of tracking these pigs down. I personally would like to see the entire Fox broadcast terror organization dismantled, dismembered, and ended. To have something like this, a propaganda organization this powerful in the middle of a country that is struggling for its own survival, is just incredible that it's allowed to continue. It is not a news gathering organization. It is a terror organization. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. The hour, sitting here during the break, just cruising around through the internet. This day in history, in the year 79 CE, was the day that Mount Vesuvius erupted and devastated the Roman cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum, killed thousands upon thousands of people. It happened around noon on August 24th, 79 CE. And there was a huge explosion on Mount Vesuvius, propelling a 10-mile-high mushroom cloud of ash and pumice into the stratosphere. Whoa. The best account of everything, according to what I have here, is Pliny the Younger, the Roman who was staying along the Bay of Naples when Vesuvius exploded. In two letters to the historian Tacitus, he told of how, quote, people covered their heads with pillows, the only defense against a shower of stones. A dark and horrible cloud, charged with combustible matter, suddenly broke and set forth. Some bewailed their own fate. Others prayed to die. He was only 17 at the time, Pliny the Younger. He escaped the catastrophe and later became a noted Roman writer and administrator. Blah, blah, blah. The eruption lasted 18 hours. Pompeii was buried under about 20 feet of ash and pumice, and then forgotten until the 18th century. Ooh, boom, boom. Boy, the things you find on the internet. You know, there's just absolutely no reason for anybody to not know things anymore. Even things like that, right? How about things like this? As promised, I mentioned this last night, New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman yesterday was kicked off the committee that is leading a 50-state task force that's looking into foreclosure abuses by the big banks and the hedge fund sons of bitches who started all this. And this committee is negotiating a possible settlement agreement with these five largest mortgage firms. This is all according to the Huffington Post. Schneiderman's position is that he doesn't want a monetary settlement until there's investigation, which certainly makes sense to me. I mean, my God. Schneiderman was one of roughly a dozen state attorneys general leading the talks with these five companies along with representatives of Obama's Department of Justice, Department of Housing and Urban Development, and other federal agencies. Now, this investigation started a few months back after widespread reports of foreclosure irregularities, like the so-called robo-signing. Remember that? The housing industry, not the housing industry, the mortgage industry just went nuts on people in the first place, setting up this horrific collapse along with the Bush crime family. As we talked about this yesterday, all that so-called prosperity, such as it was during the Bush years, had nothing to do with reality. This housing price inflation bubble was deliberately created by Greenspan and other members of the Bush crime family to hide the fact that the economy was tanking over 8 years, just going right into the toilet. So now, when there should be an investigation, the Obama administration, I'm sorry, my dear liberal and progressive radio and television colleagues, but that's where this is coming from. The progressive liberal, sarcasm mode on, Obama administration is insisting that there be no investigation at all. Just settle, give us some money, go home, so these rat bastards can do it again. Eh? Sarcasm mode off. So Schneiderman doesn't want to do that. But state prosecutors and federal officials are pressing to complete this proposed settlement with the five companies, even though these various state and federal officials have initiated only a limited investigation that has not examined the full extent of the alleged wrongdoing. And this is where the disagreement with New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman comes in. Now, last month, Huffington Post reported that Elizabeth Warren, who until recently was a senior advisor to Obama and Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary Geithner, Elizabeth Warren told a congressional panel last month that government agencies may not have sufficiently investigated claims that borrowers' homes were illegally seized. There's that aspect, too, right? Oh, but no. The Obama administration and some of these attorneys general, state attorneys general are claiming, that's okay, never mind. You know, people, thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of families' lives were totally disrupted, totally kicked to the curb. In addition to unemployment, in addition to losing everything they had, home foreclosure, illegal. But no, let's not investigate. See, this is, a lot of people wonder, Jesus Christ, Malloy, are you a communist? How did you come to hate capitalism so much? Well, here's one example. They are legion, but here's one. Here's one. I remember years ago when I was younger, I used to think about financing a house. Not me financing one, but how it all worked. You buy, back in the day, you buy a $100,000 house. Holy Toledo, that was just an enormous price to pay for a house. But you get a $100,000 house, you take a 30-year mortgage. How much are you going to pay back? $250,000. How does that work? Wait. Why is it that way? And I can never figure it out. The house is worth $100,000. You're going to pay back $250,000. I mean, that's not the way it works when you buy a car. Why is it? Well, of course, I came to realize how all that works. But anyway, the Obama administration, it says here, officials, in particular Treasury Secretary Geithner and HUD Secretary Sean Donovan, have publicly stated on numerous occasions that they want a quick resolution to this mortgage probe. No. Let's get it over with. Come on, quick. Pull the curtain back. Hide things. We don't want all this coming out. We don't want the curtain back, removed, so you can see this mass of worms and rats squirming around inside the mortgage industry. No. We have to protect that. We are capitalists of the highest order. You think we work for you, the people? Oh, for Christ's sake, smarten up. You the people? Okay. Sources told Huffington Post that attorneys general like Schneiderman along with the top legal officers from Massachusetts, Delaware, Nevada, among others, were complicating the goal of a quick settlement by questioning the plan to scuttle the state and federal investigations in exchange for the settlement. Yeah, they were making it hard for the Obama administration officials to cover this back up quickly because the stench is starting to filter out across the country. Quick, cover up the sewer. Don't let anybody know these deep, dark secrets of predatory capitalism. Oh, my God. And Schneiderman says, no, wait. We don't want to sign off on an agreement that kills our investigations or prevents new ones from being launched. Hold on. So what is happening to Schneiderman? Remember what happened to the Earth Sciences guy that worked for the Obama administration who complained about dead polar bears? Remember what happened to him? He's now under investigation. Well, at least they haven't produced any video of Schneiderman going into a whorehouse yet.
For trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now. I'm coming to reward them.
Mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. We're talking about Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of the state of New York, and how he was kicked off a committee yesterday because he wants to further investigate these predatory lending practices of the zombie, murderous, predatory capitalist banks that have destroyed and continue to destroy the entire economy. Schneiderman wants to find out what's really going on, and the feds and other states' attorneys general are saying, no, you don't need to know that. We're going to take the money. The attorneys general from those states, Massachusetts, Delaware, and Nevada, along with New York, and those other attorneys general are Martha Coakley in Massachusetts, Beau Biden, yeah, the vice president's son in Delaware, Catherine Mosto in Nevada, and, of course, Eric Schneiderman. Those four attorneys general say no, that they don't want to sign off. They don't want to kill their ongoing investigations or prevent new ones from being launched. This was a massive multi-trillion dollar fraud. This makes Bernie Madoff, who's serving the rest of his life in prison, look like, somebody begging for alms on a street corner. The crimes committed, the fraud committed by these massive, filthy, murderous banks. And what does the Obama administration say? Well, we'll send Bernie Madoff to prison. But the big banks? Oh, no. Leave him alone. In a statement of support for Schneiderman, Beau Biden, the top law enforcement in Delaware, the attorney general there, Biden said that, quote, the events leading up to the mortgage crisis must be fully investigated, including origination and securitization practices, before any broad immunity is granted, end quote. He added the American people deserve an investigation. Well, the American people don't deserve a bag of snot. Are you kidding? Mr. Biden, sure, you're absolutely right. But look who you're dealing with. Do you think these banking institutions, these mortgage lenders, these hedge fund operators, these bundlers, these people that perpetrated the most massive fraud in the history of the world against the American people, and then it rippled out against people all over the globe, do you think they really consider the ideal that the American people deserve an investigation? Oh, excuse me while I laugh myself into hysterics. Well, at the same time, Mr. Beau Biden, Mr. Eric Schneiderman, and the rest, Miss Catherine Masto, Miss Martha Coakley, you're absolutely right. You folks are right. But you realize what an anachronism you are, the four of you taken together? Do you realize that you represent a period of time, recent, I guess, where there was an interest in truth, in protecting the American consumer, especially on this level? We're not talking about somebody who sold bad television sets here. We're not talking about people who put cake mixers on the market that didn't work. We're talking about multiple trillions of dollars in fraud deliberately, specifically perpetrated against 300 million people. Plus, because it rippled out all over the globe. Of course these banks want to say, you know what they want to settle for? Well, yeah, here, we'll give you $50 billion. Please? Do you know what $50 billion is compared to the fraud perpetrated? It's a rounding error. It's nothing. It's non-existent. It's a little beep. And that's what these five banks want to settle for. And apparently that's what the Obama administration is pushing to get. Oh, well, listen, let's just let all this go. Top Obama administration officials recently reached out to Schneiderman, it says here. By the way, you can get this. You ought to sign up for TVNewsLies.org for their daily news summary. Just go sign up, TVNewsLies.org. This is where I get a lot of stuff now. And this is at Huffington Post. It's also at Bloomberg Business Week. It's all over the place. But you can get an immediate look of the stories that are going to drive you nuts. Okay, maybe you don't want to do it then. Just go to TVNewsLies.org. Top Obama administration officials recently reached out to Schneiderman. Reached out. Yeah, they reached out. Here, Eric, here, the reach out inside the hand that's reached out is a grenade with the pin pulled, right? They reached out to Schneiderman and his allies, effectively requesting that he get in line. Huh? Get in line! Sounds like something you'd hear from a mafia capo, doesn't it? Hey, get in line! But the New York Times editorial board yesterday declared that Schneiderman, quote, should stand his ground in not supporting the deal, end quote. The New York Times. New York Times doesn't want to see this probe not happen. More in a minute.
Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling.
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour, Eric Schneiderman has been kicked off the committee leading the 50-state task force charged with probing foreclosure abuses by the predatory capitalists who run the mortgage industry, among other things. Eric Schneiderman and three other attorneys general want to continue the investigations, both criminal and civil, to find out the extent to which these so-called lending institutions destroyed the economy, forced people out of their own homes, lied, cheated, stole, committed massive multi-trillion dollar fraud. And the Obama administration says, no, back off. Everybody back off. Take a deep breath. We're going to settle for some cash here. We're going to get $50 billion, which, like I said, is a rounding error when you consider the amounts of money involved here that were extracted from the middle class and the working poor and the rest of us. The board, this committee leading the task force, said, quote, the administration, that would be Barack Obama, I don't care, you know, screw this, the administration or the White House or the office of the president. Those are inanimate objects. They don't talk. So let's put it in a way we can understand it. The Obama spokesperson or Obama says that a settlement would quickly deliver much needed relief to hard pressed borrowers. Oh, sure. Just like what was appropriated to help hard pressed borrowers a year ago, a year and a half ago. What, 50, 60 billion? How's that plan working out, huh? What do they have left in that fund? They still have 80, 90% of it? What's happening to the money there? Nothing. It's kind of the point. You see, the lending institutions that screwed everything up, they don't want any deals. They want to get the property back. Get out of my house, family. I am a bank. I'm a lending institution. Get out of my house. This is my house. But where are we going to live? I don't give a goddamn. Go live in your car. Get out of my house. So that when the housing market comes back, even if it doesn't come back, one more property for these predatory leeches to sell again. This is awful. This is horrifying. So there is no quick relief going to be provided to hard-pressed borrowers. It doesn't make any difference what this board says. The email announcing Schneiderman's dismissal from the state's executive committee was sent just after noon yesterday to more than 50 people by someone named Patrick Madigan, a top lawyer in the Iowa Attorney General's office. Iowa is, I guess, the state that's leading this. You know, they put this group together, and the leader is Iowa's Attorney General. But Patrick Madigan, who's not the Attorney General, he's a lawyer in the Iowa Attorney General's office, sent the note to the committee. It said, effective immediately, the New York Attorney General's office has been removed from the executive committee of the robo-signing multi-state investigation. Gone. You're out of here. Scram. Get away, Eric Schneiderman. We don't want you. Now, just this month, Schneiderman had accused the Bank of New York Mellon. Mellon Bank, the 11th largest U.S. bank by assets, of, quote, repeated fraud and illegality. Repeated fraud and illegality when it came to its actions as a trustee for various mortgage securities. And he accused Bank of America of fabricating missing documents when foreclosing on some homeowners who defaulted on their mortgages. Fabricating missing documents. In other words, they made crap up. We don't have enough. We can't prove we own that house. Yeah, make something up. What happens to the homeowner in a case like that? The homeowner doesn't have an ice cube's chance in hell. First of all, the homeowner's losing everything or has lost everything. What's he going to do? Hire a lawyer? And how's that going to happen? And how many of those homeowners were single parents, men or women, or people with one income coming in, or no income coming in? Caught by the short hairs in the most predatory, vicious, vile financial scheme ever perpetrated in this country. Nobody uses that phrase, huh? You don't see these geniuses on CNBC and the rest of these television channels who allegedly are interested in what's going on financially in this country. No, they're not. They're interested just like anchor people on any news channel. Well, let me see what I can do here to stroke the power. The largest fraud ever perpetrated against American people. if you discount some of our wars, of course. I'm talking about monetary fraud, not fraud in blood and death and destruction. That's a whole different topic, but we're talking about the essential elements of capitalism here. The essential, the foundational elements of capitalism. Fabricating missing documents. That can only mean one thing. They're a bunch of goddamn liars. Liars. And who's going to stop them? Who's going to say, okay, you folks broke the law. Didn't Mitt Romney say corporations are people? Shouldn't somebody's ass go to prison? Look at poor old Bernie Madoff. What did Bernie Madoff do? Woo! A pyramid scheme with a bunch of rich bastards and institutions and so on and so forth. Oh, my God, did they nail him quick, right? Ba-bang! Into prison you go, Bernie. You don't mess over the wealthy in this country. And now look at this. We want to close this investigation. We're going to settle with the banking industry here. Some freak in the Obama administration says, we don't want this to go any further at all because, you know, the purpose of our 50-state committee is to produce a cover-up. And we're going to get money. You know, we might get 50, 60 billion in a consent order from these bastards. Well, you know what a consent order, of course, that means I didn't do anything wrong and I promise not to do it again. Where do I sign? That's a consent order. In this kind of action. But Eric Schneiderman, New York Attorney General. Nah, I don't think so. Oh, well, no soup for you. Bang! Off the committee. See how that works? Now, the discussions that are going on that the Obama administration wants to continue and do away with all this investigative crap, this criminal charges nonsense. Come on, come on, come on, Eric. Wake up. Smell the whatever it is. The state and federal discussions with the targeted banks. Who are they? J.P. Morgan Chase. Oh, Bank of America. Wells Fargo. Citigroup. And Ally Financial. You see their commercials on television all the time, don't you? Huh? Hey, come here. Come over here. Psst, come here, buddy. Hiya, hiya, step right up. I'm a bank. Man, have I got a deal for you. Hey, come here. The discussions with the targeted banks center on the banks providing distressed homeowners, don't you like that term, distressed homeowners, with reduced monthly payments, lower mortgage principal amounts. Oh, I get it. Okay, we're going to screw you, tattoo you, and turn you inside out with fraud, deception, illegal activity. But here's the deal we'll make you now. We'll reduce your monthly payment. Ha ha! You continue to pay for what we did to you, but at a lower rate. Is that a deal or what? Wow! Woohoo! See how predatory capitalism works? It's never enough. It's never enough. These mortgage banks have made trillions, trillions of dollars, wringing every kind of payment they can out of anyone who came near these bundled up mortgage securities. And now they want more. More. We're going to bleed you sons of bitches until you're pale. Even you black folk are going to turn white, but not the way you might think. Now, all these big banks want, in exchange for lower monthly payments, lower principal amounts, all they want is a release from liability for past illegal actions. Oh, is that all? That's all you want. You just want the homeowners to sign off that says, okay, my mortgage payment will go from $1,000 a month all the way down to $750, but I have to agree that I don't do anything, not that I could, to sue you. I can't form a class action anymore because the Supreme Court says, no, 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 that's too punitive to corporations. So all you have to do, distressed homeowner, is sign off. Take your lower mortgage payment, even though the mortgage was a fraud, and sign off, and everything, Everything will be okay. Between these predatory, murderous banks and the Obama administration, an agreement could yield up to $30 billion. I said 50 earlier. $30 billion. Oh, my goodness. That's even less than a rounding error. That's nothing. I know. To you and me, that's a lot of money. But to the mortgage banking industry, to the predatory banks, to these capitalist pigs who have done this, $30 billion? Jesus Christ. Where do I sign, right? $30 billion. Now, the bigger the effective grant of immunity from potential government civil lawsuits, not criminal, but civil, the more cash the companies are willing to pay to settle the accusations. You see how that works? So, excuse me, Eric Schneiderman was a fly in the ointment. So get rid of him. Let's get the $30 billion. His spokesman, Danny Kanner, said, quote, Schneiderman is committed to a comprehensive resolution. While we will continue to work with Delaware, Nevada, and Massachusetts and our other federal and state counterparts to achieve those goals, a comprehensive solution, ongoing investigations by attorneys general cannot be shut down by efforts to settle quickly, and those responsible must be held accountable. Oh, now there's a novel idea. Must be held accountable for perpetrating the largest fraud ever against the American public? Held accountable? Well, that's crazy talk. Accountable? We decided not to hold anybody accountable when Bush and Cheney walked free. We have war criminals among us. We have mass killers. We're going to hold banks accountable? Oh, please. Oh, my God, please. Kanner also said, Schneiderman's spokesperson, that Schneiderman was removed by Attorney General, Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, and it was his prerogative. Attorney General of Iowa Miller said through a spokesman that Schneiderman was, quote, intimately involved in every aspect of this investigation and possible settlement, end quote. From the launch of the probe last October to this past June, Schneiderman, the spokesman went on to say, was, quote, on every internal executive committee conference call and participated in all conference calls and meetings with the top five mortgage servicers. As such, New York had a large influence on the actions and decisions of the multi-state investigation, end quote. So what? That doesn't mean anything. This freak might as well sit there and say, yesterday, listen, it was very humid here in Iowa. The temperature was 88 degrees with the possibility of thunderstorms. It has nothing to do with what Eric Schneiderman wants to continue with. Investigations! But never mind. In June, after the Huffington Post reported on a confidential conference call between state and federal officials, the executive committee was reduced to a smaller group of states that would directly negotiate with the five predatory, murderous, sons of bitchin' banks. Schneiderman was invited to join the smaller group, but said no. Not going to negotiate. Well, so the Attorney General of Iowa, Tom Miller, continued, quote, since that time, New York has actively worked to undermine the very same multi-state group that it has spent the previous 9 months working very closely with. And why is that, Mr. Miller? Because Schneiderman wants to pursue civil and criminal actions independent of a settlement against these predatory banks. I mean, that's how it reads to me, but then I'm just a 25-cent radio host. What the hell do I know? Miller continued, quote, "While we certainly respect the right of any state to choose to no longer participate in a multi-state settlement and to pursue another path, working to actively undermine a multi-state agreement while still a member of the executive committee simply doesn't make sense, is unprecedented, and is unacceptable. Accordingly, today I inform New York that it no longer is a member of the executive committee," end quote. Well, so much for justice. Iowa? Gosh. Schneiderman's removal, of course, will make it a lot easier for everybody in on the scam to reach an accord with the five banks. However, now that Schneiderman's gone, now that the threat is removed, the only way you get capitalists to agree to anything is to threaten to decapitate them. That threat is now gone. So, the potential amount of money that this investigation will be able to extract from these predatory bastards is going to go straight down. $30 billion? Listen, we'll settle for 15. Now that you got rid of that punk Schneiderman, hey, we're J.P. Morgan Chase. We're Bank of America. We're Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally Financial. How much you want? Here, wait a minute. Let me get in here. I've got it here in the top drawer in the petty cash. We'll take $15 billion or get out of town. What do you want, huh? Schneiderman does have a couple arrows in his quiver. He is armed with New York State's Martin Act, which means he can bring suit against alleged fraudsters without having to prove that they intended to commit fraud. New York's top legal officer is investigating whether banks followed the state's laws when bundling mortgages into securities. That probe could prove explosive. Adam Levitin, a bankruptcy expert and professor at Georgetown University Law Center, told a congressional panel last November that if mortgages were not properly transferred in the securitization process, then mortgage-backed securities would in fact not be backed by any mortgages whatsoever, which could cloud title to nearly every property in the United States and could lead to trillions of dollars in losses. Oh, my goodness. Is that why the banks want to settle for $15 billion or nothing? Take it and get out of here. You got rid of Schneiderman, right? You see how predatory capitalism, but I'm repeating myself, operates? I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Mortgage rate.